You're listening to Under Surveillance, WLEW's look at the intersection of popular culture, politics, and sociology. My name is Kevin Fulham, and I'll be joined every second and fourth Wednesday mornings by a series of guests as we examine everything from the depiction of American government in film and television to notable themes in various genres of cinema. For more information or to access previous shows and related essays, head to www.undersurveillance.org. That's www.undersurveillance.org. Today on Under Surveillance, we'll be discussing the world of horror films, everything from how various trends are reflective of their cultural contexts, to the differences between American and foreign perspectives on horror, to the use and depiction of religion within the genre. My guest is Kendall Phillips, professor of communication and rhetorical studies at Syracuse University, and the author of the book Projected Fears. That's up next on Under Surveillance. Good morning, and welcome to another edition of Under Surveillance on WLEW. My name is Kevin Fulham, and today on the show, we'll be discussing the horror genre of cinema. And joining me is Kendall Phillips, professor of communication and rhetorical studies at Syracuse University, and the author of the book Projected Fears, which examines 10 landmark horror films and how they've reflected their respective cultural contexts. Welcome to the show, Kendall.
Hey, Kevin. Thanks for having me on.
And so I want to start by talking about the current state of horror in 2009. And you commented in your book that many of the horror tales of the 70s, certainly the landmark ones like Exorcist and Texas Chainsaw Massacre, emerged from the cynicism of the hippie movement running through America at that time, the post-hippie movement in the early 70s. And it would seem that the general political attitude among young people today would be one that's more optimistic, considering their support for Obama. What are your thoughts as far as the current trends involving horror and how the current political climate might impact the styles of horror films that we'll see in the next few years?
Yeah, it's generally true. I think you're absolutely right that horror films tend to emerge, you know, most dramatically in times of cultural anxiety. And so, yeah, the 70s, you look at that period from really 68 to about 78, which was, you know, end of Vietnam and Watergate and the hippie movement and kind of violence in the country. And so, you know, it was a really dark time for America. And, of course, that's one of the golden ages of horror. And, in fact, if you look back, the first kind of golden age of horror was, like, started in 1931 with Dracula and Frankenstein and the sort of universal gothic monsters. And, of course, that was the worst year of the Great Depression. So, you know, people, when times are tough, for some reason people want to go into movie theaters and be scared. So as for an optimistic time, you know, it is, you know, hope, change we can believe in. So here we are in, you know, the Obama era, and so it is a little bit hard to imagine what the anxieties of the culture are. But, you know, there are some good examples of horror films that came out in relatively prosperous times, and one of those is Psycho. It came out in 1960, which was generally, you know, a period where there wasn't any major military conflict, the economy was booming, and yet there's always some sort of dark current lingering under the surface. So it'll be interesting to see what the Obama era manifests in terms of horrible monsters on the screen.
Why do you feel that Psycho resonated so much with the American public?
Well, I mean, one thing is, you know, Psycho is brilliant. I mean, it's just, it's the one film, and I teach film at Syracuse, and so I teach classes and show a lot of horror films, and that Psycho is the one film I show every time I teach a class, because it is just a masterful example of a great craftsman in Hitchcock putting together, you know, everything he's got into that film, and it really just all comes together quite beautifully. But I think the other part about Psycho, you know, people watch Psycho or they remember Psycho, and what they remember is the shower scene and Norman and Mother, right? That's sort of the central part of the film for most people's recollections. But if you go back and watch the film, a lot of it is about this desire to kind of get away, which I think is very much leaked into the growth of suburbanization in America in the late 1950s and early 60s. You know, that was the period of mass migration out of cities into these sort of satellite bedroom communities out into the suburbs, where people were much more isolated than they had been in neighborhoods in the cities. So if you watch, you know, Psycho, a lot of it's about Marion Crane, you know, stealing money to get away to her own private island, which is kind of one of the words she uses to explain her dream. She wants her own little private space to get away from everybody, which is exactly what Americans wanted in the suburban period. And, of course, what does she find? She finds Norman in his little own private island, but it's not quite what she expected to find.
Yeah, and in terms of the suburbanization, clearly you have that as a theme involving Halloween, which came later in the 70s.
Absolutely. That whole period of the 70s, not only was it, you're exactly right, not only was it suburbanization, but it was sort of, it was a period where, you know, people didn't want traditional family values, God help us using that phrase now, but the 70s was certainly a period where America seemed to pull away from that idea of mom and dad at home and taking care of the kids, and, you know, it was much more free and open and experimental, and people didn't want to be so tied down, and so what comes out are films like Halloween and Friday the 13th and Nightmare on Elm Street that are about what happens to the kids when mom and dad leave them at home.
And also in terms of suburbs, no one knows their neighbors. You know, you have the typical line whenever a murder happens, well, you know, I never imagined it could come from such a person or it could happen in such a
That's
nice
right.
neighborhood.
He seemed so nice. I never talked to him. But he
yeah.
Seemed, I'm of the age that Halloween was that first big scary movie for me. You know, and I remember seeing it pretty young kid, saw it in the movie theater, and the part in my childhood memory that really stands out is the sequence where Jamie Lee Curtis is running from, you know, Michael Myers, and she's banging on her neighbor's doors, and you can see their lights come on, and they kind of look out the window, and they shut the shades, lock the door, and turn the lights off, like they just completely don't want anything to do with it. And the segment actually lasts about, like, 48 seconds, but in my memory as a little kid who was living in a suburb like that, you know, it seemed like it took hours of her running through this maze of anonymous suburban houses with no one willing to help, because that must have just really touched a nerve in my little teenage psyche.
Do you think audiences are harder to frighten as time passes?
You know, it's funny, that's a very common question, and I think no. The key, I think, is that with monsters, familiarity doesn't just breed contempt, familiarity breeds derision, right? So, think about it, when Dracula and Frankenstein came out in 1931, and my father tells the story of Hemer went to see Dracula when he was a little kid, and he's riding home, and he was terrified that every tree limb was Dracula reaching out to get him. Now, if anybody watches Dracula now, it's hard to imagine anyone being frightened by it. I mean, it's kind of stagey, it's a little bit hammy, it's a little bit campy, but at the time, it was terrifying because people were not prepared for that. But then after, you know, a few years of seeing films like that and all the sequels and all the other kind of universal monster films, people got familiar with it, and then it became silly. And so in 1948, which is, you know, just a few years later, Abbott and Costello meet Frankenstein, you know, the inevitable lampoon and parody. And then, you know, Dracula and Frankenstein are still around, but no one really finds them frightening today. And I think that happens with every genre of, or every iteration of the horror genre. Something new comes out, like a Psycho or like Dracula or like Halloween, that is a different twist on the traditional kind of gothic horror tale, and people really get freaked out by that. They get quite frightened by that. They're quite taken by that violation of their expectations. But then after a few cycles, you know, everybody kind of tries to cash in on the success of those films. People get used to it, and it gets familiar, and then people say, oh, we're too jaded, we can't be frightened, until, you know, along comes a film like Blair Witch Project, which, you know, was a low-budget film, kind of came out of nowhere, and yet really took the country by storm, made hundreds of millions of dollars, because it was such a different way of telling those stories. So I think we're at a period where we're just waiting for the next filmmaker to come along and find a way to frighten us.
Well, I think you're exactly right in terms of something like, you know, Dracula came out, you know, back in 1931, and clearly it's a very dated film, I think, if you would watch it today. But, you know, here we are, 2009, and vampire movies are still being made all the time. You know, you still Let the Right One In, the recent Swedish film. You have the True Blood HBO series. It seems like, you know, vampires never go out of style. Haunted houses never go out of style. The recent film The Orphanage was a Spanish film that just came out a couple of years ago. And even with monsters, I mean, I completely agree that, you know, you can't do another Wolfman story. You can't do, it'll be tough to do Frankenstein. But you still have variations on that monster theme.
Oh, absolutely. No, I think you're absolutely right. The core elements, even all the way back to the 18th century Gothic literature, you know, the core precept of Gothic literature was that there are secretly two worlds. There's the world of day, which is the one you and I live in and drive in and commute in and go to the restaurant in, all those sorts of things. And then somewhere in the corner, in the basement, in that, you know, in the attic or hiding in the cemetery, is this world of night. And every once in a while, we accidentally step over the line and find ourselves in a world of supernatural entities and scary monsters and things like that. And those basic precepts work their way through almost everything. The key is, I think, that there is a way of presenting that core story. And once the way of presenting the story gets too familiar, then it ceases to frighten us. But then every once in a while, someone will come along with a different way of playing out that theme. And so you think about even the vampire popularity today with Twilight and True Blood and all those sorts of things. Very few of those are frightening. or even meant to frighten us. Their love stories or romances or seductions or whatever. If someone wanted to take the vampire and make it frightening again, then they're going to have to do something really different, like the film Let the Right One In, which is a beautifully told rendering of the vampire story, but told through a very different perspective than the previous films.
My name is Kevin Fulham, and you're listening to Under Surveillance on WLEW, and I'm joined today by Kendall Phillips, Professor of Communication and Rhetorical Studies at Syracuse University, and the author of the book Projected Fears, which examines 10 landmark horror films and how they've reflected their respective cultural contexts. And we've been talking a little bit about the subject of whether audiences are tougher to frighten as time passes. Do you think that we've become more desensitized to violence?
I think we've become familiar with a lot of the tricks of displaying violence, but I don't. No, I don't think so. I think that's a pretty typical charge. And what I find interesting, and as another book I've done is a history of controversies over film, and so a lot of controversies have been about violence. And all the way back into the 1890s, people were condemning films for being too violent. How can you show such violent acts? And so here we are, over 100 years later, and people are basically still saying, oh, these horrible violent films. So I think we can still be shocked by violence. I think we can be offended by violence. What often happens, though, is people get used to the tricks of the way directors show violence. So we get used to big bloody splatters. We get used to dramatic car chases, or we get used to gun battles in the streets. And so then a director has to come by, like Eli Roth did in the film Hostel, which presented violence in a really savagely brutal way that really disturbed people. And that was just a few years ago.
Yeah, we've had Hostel, Saw, Funny Games, and The Strangers. And you've labeled certainly Hostel a torture porn sort of film. So I do like the label. But is there a reason why we've seen the emergence of those kinds of films in recent years? Films that are all about, I guess they might just be considered, exercises in sadism.
And masochism for us as the audience to want to go see.
Sure, sure.
Absolutely. It's always tough to, as a rhetorical scholar or a kind of historian of culture, to get a good bead on where you are. And you always kind of know that 20 years from now, you may look back and say, oh, now I get it. Now I see what's going on. But when you look at films like this cycle of the kind of torture porn films, you can't help but notice, and maybe it's so obvious as to me not worth mentioning, but that these emerged right after September 11th. And if you go back to the first film in this cycle, which was that film Saw, the tagline for Saw was effectively, how much blood would you spill to stay alive, right? How far would you go to stay alive? And goodness gracious, wasn't that exactly the political question America was being asked in the post-9/11 era? How far would you go to protect your national security, your way of life, or whatever? And then, of course, you look at a film like Hostel that really taps into those anxieties of Americans abroad in an angry world that hates Americans, that tortures us, even as the film is being released in the midst of the photos from Abu Ghraib and the controversy of American treatment of detainees. So all that anxiety, all of that global tension, xenophobia, paranoia, fear, et cetera, terrorism, is circulating in the cultural consciousness of America, and then these films come out, and suddenly people look at those films and say, yeah, that makes sense to me.
A few moments ago, I mentioned the film The Orphanage, which is a Spanish film, came out a couple of years ago, and basically deals with a woman who loses an adopted son. She is actually staying in the orphanage in which she grew up when she was a kid, and strange things start happening. Before the boy disappeared, he commented that he had imaginary friends, and as time goes on, you're starting to wonder whether those friends were really imaginary. What sorts of differences do you see between American and foreign cinema with regards to the relationship between horror films and societal fears? I don't know if it's something that you've looked at very much. It seems like Japan and Spain are the two countries where we seem to get maybe more of the landmark horror films here in the States.
No, absolutely. I think one of the bright spots in the contemporary age, because this is, in some ways, it's an interesting period for American horror because it is so dominated by the endless remakes that just feel like some Hollywood corporate accountant cashing in, right? I mean, maybe that's not fair, but it just feels like an actuarialist is going, here's the target demographic, let's make a movie for that. But then you look overseas, and you see, absolutely, these beautiful films coming out of Spain, The Orphanage, and even Pan's Labyrinth, and even before that, The Others, which was directed by a Spanish director, which have this beautiful Gothic feel, and they have this lovely motif of mothers and children, and you just feel so much bound up in a kind of cultural logic that feels that alienation and loss. Or you look over to Japan and Korea, where you have a whole host of really intense, violent films, of which my favorite is Audition, which is just a mind-blowingly disturbing film about pain and suffering, et cetera. Or, as you said before, this beautiful Swedish film, Let the Right One In, that tells the vampire tale through a kind of child's fairy tale. What I love about those films is that they do challenge our American sensibilities, because you're absolutely right, they're coming out of a different kind of national framework.
Can you talk about Audition a little bit more?
Audition is what Hitchcock would do today if A, he were living in Japan, and B, he were really, really angry. It's this really odd story about a man who loses his wife, and his friend convinces him that to get a new wife, they'll pretend to be making a movie, and they'll audition these women, and whichever one he likes, he will then seduce. Unfortunately for him, the woman he picks is deeply disturbed, and the ending is such a shocking moment of violence. I think it ranks up there on the screen with the shower scene murder in Psycho, but I won't ruin it for people, except to say, if you go out and rent Audition or grab it off Netflix, don't think I'm wrong when it seems to be a long, tedious story about a guy trying to find a wife. It really has payoff in the end.
Well, in terms of Japan, we've seen American remakes of films like The Ring, which was Ringu, I think, in Japan, and also The Grudge. Have certain American translations of foreign films not worked as well because of cultural differences?
Well, that's a good question. I would say, from my point of view, and I'm probably a little bit of a horror film snob, a remake like Ring is disappointing because what it loses is exactly what you were mentioning earlier. There's something about seeing a foreign film, and I think especially a foreign horror film, where the cultural sensibility, so for instance, in the original Japanese Ringu, the fact that one of these characters is psychic and picks up psychic resonances and has kind of a spiritual connection is just natural, right? No one has to explain it, or it's not dismissed. Whereas in the American version, that's kind of written out and taken away because Americans don't have that kind of cultural sensibility.
My name is Kevin Fulham, and I'm talking to Kendall Phillips, who is a professor of communication and rhetorical studies at Syracuse University. He's also the author of the book Projected Fears, which examines 10 landmark horror films and how they've reflected their respective cultural contexts. And today on Under Surveillance, we're talking about the horror genre of cinema, and talking a few moments ago about American remakes of films that originated overseas. And just in terms of remakes in general, I actually did a show about this a while back where I talked about Hollywood remakes, and specifically it seems that horror movies get remade much more often than any other type of genre. The Hills Have Eyes have been remade,
oh, yeah.
Or Texas Chainsaw Massacre. The Thing, originally released in the 50s, John Carpenter's version came out in the early 80s, and I think they're releasing another version in the near future. And
yeah.
The Hitcher, which came out in 1985, they've already remade that, you know, only 20 years later. Why do you think that's the case specifically in terms of horror movies?
Well, I think there are two things. One is several of these franchises have kind of iconic figures that are prepackaged marketing. So, you know, Leatherface from Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Michael Myers in Halloween, to some extent Dawn of the Dead. Certainly there's a remake currently in preparation for a remake of Nightmare on Elm Street, so Freddy Krueger. So these characters all have that kind of iconicity, even though the current kind of target audience of teenagers, if they've seen those movies, they saw them on cable or they saw them on DVD, but they're not as familiar with them. So there's some desire to kind of see if lightning will strike twice, if you can make a huge franchise out of one of these iconic horror films from the past. And then the other thing is, you know, those, personally, I prefer the older films, but I'm old, right? Those older films, as great as they are, often don't fit with the contemporary cinematic aesthetic. So my favorite example of that is, if you go back and watch the original Dawn of the Dead, 1978, George Romero, great film. I think it's one of the smartest horror films ever made, but it's incredibly slow. And in fact, in some ways, the most beautiful part of the film is the extended sort of second act in which the characters have barricaded themselves into a shopping mall, surrounded by living dead, but they're safe inside, and they suddenly find that they really have no purpose in life, just being stuck in the shopping mall, surrounded by stuff, but nothing to do with it. And that's what makes the film a beautiful film, and also a really smart political critique of consumerist culture in the 1970s, like the birth of the shopping mall. Fast forward to the more recent example, Zack Snyder's remake. It's fast-paced, it's action, it's a lot of heads blowing up and shooting zombies and running and screaming and shouting, and very little of that malaise, that angst, that kind of existential wondering about what it is we're supposed to do in a consumer culture. And so for me, a lot of these more recent remakes have taken the images, the icon, and then they've speeded it up and, for me, washed a lot of the political substance out of the film.
In terms of cultural context, we talked about maybe the remake's not reflecting those same sorts of political sensibilities. What's your take on a film like American Psycho? The novelization was written by Bret Easton Ellis, which came out right at the tail end of the 80s, I believe.
That's right,
and it's a critique on the yuppie culture of the Reagan era. The film starts Christian Bale, and he's basically a high-powered guy in the finance world who kind of seems empty and sees life as meaningless and starts killing people just for the heck of it.
He's the ultimate Reagan yuppie.
Exactly. But
the film, everybody.
The film wasn't released until 2000.
It's funny how time erases these things. As you'll probably remember, when American Psycho came out, I remember I went to get a copy because I liked Bret Easton Ellis. So I went to get a copy of the book when it came out from like a Barnes & Noble or something. It wasn't displayed anywhere, and so I had to go up and say, excuse me, do you have this new Bret Easton Ellis book? And they said, you mean American Psycho? And I said, yeah, and they had hidden it behind the counter because it was so controversial, and a lot of organizations, women's groups, et cetera, protested the book because it had such horrifically graphic, over-the-top displays of violence, particularly against women. So, you know, at the time, no studio in the world was going to touch that film because it was pure lightning. It was a landmine waiting to be stepped on. So years later, it finally gets into production, and Mary Harron picks it up, and female director, and great sensibility, really, really smart director, and focuses the film much more on that kind of political critique of consumerist yuppie culture, which, of course, is not what the average American filmgoer who sees a title like American Psycho expects they're going to get.
That's interesting, though, that the book would be hidden at Barnes & Noble. I mean, you think maybe, okay, in a public library they might hide that sort of thing, but not in a commercial bookstore.
No, and what I really love is, just not long ago, I was in a Barnes & Noble to give a talk or something and was walking through and noticed on one of their, you know, tables of great American books or great American literature, there was a stack of American Psychos, you know, just wide out for anybody to see. And I suddenly flashed back to the person behind the counter kind of pulling it out, and I think actually wrapped it or put it in a bag like almost immediately, like it was some sort of horrible pornographic book or something. I felt dirty leaving the store with it, but now it's sitting there as Great American Fiction and you know, American Psycho's on the cable network, so, you know, people forget how intense things were at the time.
Kendall, you wrote about the rise of strong female heroes in horror films. We have Jamie Lee Curtis's character in Halloween. Certainly Sigourney Weaver playing Ripley in the Aliens films. And is there a reason why we don't seem to see powerful female villains in horror films?
Boy, it's interesting. The female villains that we do see tend to either be kind of demonic figures, mother figures, or jilted lovers. So, like, the closest we get, so, like, Fatal Attraction is your iconic, and I think recently there was a film very much like, I can't remember the title right now, but there's a film very much like Fatal Attraction about a woman falling in love with someone's husband and then kind of going crazy and boiling the bunny and all that sort of stuff. So you get the kind of crazy jilted lover, you get the kind of crazy mother figure, and here I'm thinking of, like, well, obviously Psycho, but also, like, Carrie. If you remember the movie Carrie, not only was Carrie kind of the villain in the movie, but really she was driven to her kind of violent, psychotic state by her horrible, clinging mother. And then you get...
And the abuse that she received at school as well, too.
Absolutely, the abuse she receives at school. And then you get this kind of unleashed teenage female. So Carrie is one, The Exorcist is another. So this kind of monstrous teenage or monstrous female. So it is interesting how much the female figure kind of gets pulled into the background. And I think part of that was the kind of, I would say, locking in of a particularly rigid version of horror that kind of starts with Psycho and really picks up with, like, Texas Chainsaw and then gets solidified in Halloween, where you have the female protagonist. She's what, there's a great scholar named Carol Clover calls her the final girl. She's the one that we know from the beginning of the film. She's the target. She's going to survive the film. She's going to make it through. And so you get these people like Jamie Lee Curtis or, you know, Sydney in the Scream films, these females who are going to kind of be our protagonist. And once you lock into them, it's harder to find a female villain as the kind of paired opposite.
There was a film that came out a few years ago called Monster, which had Charlize Theron, and she portrayed a serial killer. But again, you know, like you're talking about with something like Carrie, I mean, she was someone who had preyed upon men that were presumably going to prey upon females.
Right.
And so she wasn't a villain in the traditional sense. One of the films that you highlighted in your book was Silence of the Lambs, which came out back in the early 90s Jodie Foster and Anthony Hopkins, where Anthony Hopkins plays Hannibal Lecter, who is a serial killer who is imprisoned, who kind of toys with Jodie Foster's character in during her mission to nab another serial killer who's on the loose.
Buffalo Bill, right?
Buffalo Bill, exactly. And it seems that, you know, later on through the film, you see Hannibal Lecter's story progresses as well, too, and he winds up escaping from prison. And it kind of seems, you know, when you watch that film, that, you know, the audience is rooting for Hannibal Lecter, even though he's a sadistic guy. Why is that the case? Why do we tend to root for those kinds of characters?
Boy, it's, you know, it's funny, especially if you follow the progression of the Hannibal Lecter character across the several films now. And apparently they're planning to make another one, so, you know, a series of films. And in each one, he becomes more sympathetic and more the kind of villainous hero. But you're absolutely right. In the first film, The Silence of the Lambs, which is actually the second film based on a Hannibal Lecter novel. There was an earlier film called Manhunter, directed by Michael Mann, of all people, that was based on Thomas Harris's first book, Red Dragon. But it was kind of a fail. The film kind of failed, and everybody forgot about it. So Silence of the Lambs was kind of really a reboot for that. But if you watch Silence, which is just a brilliantly well-made film, Lecter is—he's a bit like Dracula in that he is dangerous, and there's always the danger he's going to consume us. I mean, you know, either physically or psychically, mentally, you know, he's going to take us over. But there's also something seductive about that monstrous figure. You know, there's something about that horribly evil, and I think particularly when he's in the cage, he's even more seductive. It's like that desire to stand really close to the lion's cage. Like, you don't want to get too close because the lion could hurt you, but you want to get just close as close as you can to sort of look it in the eye and feel that kind of menace. And so then, and for me at least, once Hannibal Lecter gets out, and then you got a film like Hannibal, and then the young Hannibal film, and whatever they're coming up with now, he loses some of that menace and becomes almost like a Freddy Krueger kind of wisecracking character.
Speaking of serial killers in general, we had Natural Born Killers, so it came out in the mid-90s, the Oliver Stone film, which had Woody Harrelson and Juliette Lewis portraying serial killers on the run that were kind of, they were turned into celebrities by this TV host. But it seems that serial killers have kind of disappeared from the pop culture scene. Is there a reason in terms of maybe cultural context why you don't see those kinds of movies made today?
It seems to me that one of the things that really drove that cycle of films that I think did start with Silence of the Lambs is kind of the serial killer slash police procedural FBI profiler sort of film, and you had things like Copycat and
Seven was another one, the David Fincher film.
Absolutely. And that was another really, really well-made film. But in each of those films, they're really about the serial killer is really like this. It's almost like the perfect example of the American ideal of the 1990s, which is like, a bit like the Christian Bale character in American Psycho. It's a self-made man who goes out and does what he wants to do. Only this time he wants to kill people and, you know, make a suit out of their skin. But the serial killers are these kind of uber individualist, late capitalist, yuppie individuals who are just out there fulfilling their own personal fantasies regardless of who they hurt. And hopefully that's faded because, you know, I'm hoping the culture maybe has shifted away from that a little bit.
You're listening to Under Surveillance on WLEW, and my name is Kevin Fulham. And today on the show, I am joined by Kendall Phillips, who is a professor of communication and rhetorical studies at Syracuse University. He's also the author of the book Projected Fears, which examines 10 landmark horror films and how they've reflected their respective cultural contexts. And we just have a few moments left. I want to talk about the role of religion and how it's evolved regarding horror. What's your take on the way in which religion has been used throughout various horror films throughout the years?
Well, I mean, generally speaking, you know, religion has been that which protects us against the monster, you know. So if you go back to, you know, the early Gothic monster films, you know, the church was often kind of the stalwart, the kind of main defense that you had. But it's always been interesting how ambivalent horror films have been with religion. So you take a film, I mean, the best example of that is The Exorcist, right? The Exorcist is, if people haven't seen it, it is full of, for want of a better term, blasphemies, out the wazoo. I mean, they're horribly, horribly heretical and blasphemous things that happen in the film. And yet, the church was generally supportive of it, and it's actually a recorded fact that after The Exorcist came out, applications to the priesthood spiked dramatically. Like, people who went to see The Exorcist decided that they wanted to go out and become a priest. So it's kind of a strange relationship.
Well, you know, Stephen King wrote in his book Danse Macabre that came out, I think, back in the early 80s. It was kind of a recollection of the horror genre, mostly concerning literature, but also film as well, too. You know, that you have all these conservative groups that typically come out against horror films, but if you look at a lot of those films, the religious figures are the ones who are the heroes, or it's the characters that are the most moral, you know, in terms of, say, Halloween. You know, Jamie Lee Curtis's character doesn't have sex, so you know, she survives, as opposed to all, you know, her teenage friends.
Yeah, it's a great debate among sort of, horror scholars, and there is a camp that kind of rally around Stephen King's idea that says, horror, generally speaking, and it's somewhat true, that monsters in horror films punish the wicked. So they're kind of like boogeymen. You know, boogeymen are these kind of folklorish figures that we can trace all the way back to ancient history, and the boogeyman was always the kind of figure that kept us out of the forbidden zone. So it's kind of like the go no further, right? You know, if you've gotten this far, stop. If you go any further, you're going to get into the boogeyman, and you're going to be punished for it. So there is the kind of conservative punisher mentality, but there are also, films that focus on conservative society as being the evil. And so I think of films like John Carpenter's They Live or even Escape from New York, in which normal society really becomes the horrible side, and the monsters are actually quite sympathetic.
And in terms of religion, one of the films I want to talk about is Rosemary's Baby.
Oh, yeah.
It's a Roman Polanski film that came out in the late 60s with Mia Farrow. And the film deals with Mia Farrow and her husband, who's played by an actor who I can't recall right now. But they're a young couple in New York City, and the husband is an aspiring actor. They move to a building where they discover they're very nice older neighbors next door. As time goes on, the couple, they want to have a child, and then you're starting to wonder about how the child has been conceived. Also, throughout the story, there's a commentary here and there more about the absence of religion, and Mia Farrow's character is at a doctor's office, and the Time magazine is staring at her and says, "God is dead." There's derision involving the Pope's visit to the States, which happened around that time. What was the public's reaction to Rosemary's Baby?
Well, it was very popular. Actually, it was a really successful film, and probably, I don't deal with it in the book, partly because The Exorcist came around just a few years later and sort of, cornered the market on that kind of film. But I do think those films, really from about 1968 to 1978, which is Rosemary's Baby and Night of the Living Dead and Texas Chainsaw and The Exorcist, fall in a period where you're exactly right. The basic cornerstones of American culture seem to be crumbling. Faith in the family, people were kind of moving away from traditional family, nuclear family ideas. Faith in government, because you had, the Vietnam War, and you had the assassination of Kennedy, and you had Watergate, and loss of faith in religion. People were moving away from traditional organized religions and leaving the churches. And so you had, in Rosemary's Baby, this classic example of a young couple who kind of don't know where life should take them. They don't have foundations. They don't have directions. They're kind of rudderless. And into this then comes these kind of malevolent forces that promise, the key, of course, is the husband is an actor, and he starts getting these great parts. And he starts getting all this success, in part, at least we believe, because the satanic cult is giving him rewards so that they can basically have the son of Satan.
In terms of religion, there's another movie that came out, I think right around 2000, 2001, called Frailty.
Yeah, it's a brilliant film, absolutely, yeah.
Okay, yeah, it's directed by Bill Paxton, the actor, who also stars in the film, and he plays the widowed father of two young sons. And he's a mechanic, and one day while working on a car, an angel appears to him, and you don't hear any of the conversation, but he comes home and he tells his sons that it's his mission in life that he has to destroy demons. And so God's told him he has to destroy demons, except that these demons look like normal people. And so he's killing people and bringing them back to the house and burying them. And of course, with the brothers, they're really very concerned about, okay, one of them thinks that the dad is completely lost, and the other one, the younger one, is totally on board.
Right, he's go dad.
And it's told in a series of flashbacks by one of the brothers, who's now an adult, and he's telling this to an FBI agent who's played by Powers Booth.
I thought it was really smart, and it was one of those films that took the really, if you, you know, a kind of caricature of the religious right that has provoked the culture wars and that has said there are prayer warriors. I mean, it's a very militant kind of discourse. And I lived for a long time in Missouri, so I've spent a lot of time around this discourse. And you know, so sort of taking Christian theology and turning it into a very aggressive, almost militaristic attack on the evil, and that there are evil forces and they must be destroyed, and you know, your prayer warrior goes after them. And so I thought Bill Paxton, who I think grew up in the Midwest, really captured a lot of that kind of language and turned it into kind of its natural conclusion, which would be essentially a serial killer who is sent by God to kill demons, to destroy. He really is a prayer warrior in the most violent possible ways. And then, of course, the film leaves us in this weird position of trying to decide whether he really is doing God's will or whether he's just some nut job who hears voices like so many nut jobs seem to. You know, and again, I think the key to any good horror film, and in a way any good film, but for me certainly a horror film, is that it shakes up our everyday regular view of the world. We are creatures of habit. We get so ingrained into our 9-to-5 sort of way of life and sit down and watch TV and eat the TV dinner or whatever it is we do, and we get into, and you know, and we start to see the world. These are the good guys and these are the bad guys, and we like them and we don't like them, and you just fall into such a rut that one of the great things that horror does and has always done is to really be like a lightning strike into that sense of normalcy. And by bringing out monsters and mysteries and demons and creatures, it really shakes up and challenges the way we think the world works. And I think that is the one great potentially political aspect of the horror film. Whatever, whether it's conservative or liberal, what horror films do is they really shake us out of our everyday malaise.
You've been listening to Under Surveillance on WLUW, and my name is Kevin Fulham, and I've been joined by Kendall Phillips, who is a professor of communication and rhetorical studies at Syracuse University. He's also the author of the book Projected Fears, which examines 10 landmark horror films and how they reflected their respective cultural contexts. And Kendall, I know you're also working on another book that's near completion called Dark Directions.
Yeah, in this book I'm really looking at what I think are the architects of that great period of horror in the 60s and 70s, which is you know, George Romero, Wes Craven, and John Carpenter. So hopefully that'll be done soon.
And you're also, you mentioned the author of another book called All About Controversial Cinema.
Yeah, so this book that came out last year called Controversial Cinema, The Films That Outraged America, and it looks at really the history of controversies from the 19th century to the present around films about sex, violence, race, and religion. And boy, there's a lot of ground there to cover.
Thank you so much, Kendall. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Kevin.
For Kendall Phillips, my name is Kevin Fulham, and you've been listening to Under Surveillance on WLUW. And for more information or to listen to archived shows, visit www.undersurveillance.org. That's www.undersurveillance.org.